It's July 26th. You're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production of the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
That's right. So excited to have a co-pilot in here with me in the H&N recording room. If you folks out there listening visit our website often at humaniststudies.org, you'll know that Jess is our new systems administrator and web programmer for the Institute for Humanist Studies. She's been working up quite a storm lately, created a new MySpace page for the Institute at myspace.com/humaniststudies. She's got a great stylized feed for our e-zine. And Jess, you've also been doing some work on our podcast, is that right?
Why, yes, Duncan, that is right.
Oh, yeah? What have you been doing?
Well, if you're listening to the show in iTunes, you can see that there's an image that pops up at relevant times, and there's also some links that you can go to external sites for some information. Also, if you burn this podcast to a CD, you can skip to the part that you'd like to listen to, different sections or chapters, if you will.
So you can skip over all of my witty banter?
Quote-unquote witty banter. That's what I'm saying, Duncan. You're welcome, folks. You're welcome.
All right. Well, that's very cool. We got a great show today. A lot of brilliant people were in Albany this month. Of course, there's always a lot of brilliant people in Albany. And they stopped by the Institute to talk with us. Chris Mooney will talk about his book, The Republican War on Science. Bioethicist Dr. Anna Lita will speak about human cloning. Washington's only full-time lobbyist for freethinkers, Lori Lipman Brown, will speak to us by phone about same-sex marriage and stem cell research. And at the end of the show, Freethunk cartoonist Jeff Swenson will review a new TV show on the USA Network called Skype. What do you think, Jess? Should we start the show by talking about same-sex marriage?
Well, it'd be pretty embarrassing for you if I said no, so let's go ahead and do that.
Oh, we got a wise guy. All right. Last month, you and I walked across the street with other IHS staff members to a rally in support of same-sex marriage in New York State. The highest court in New York, located here in Albany, heard arguments for and against same-sex marriage. This month, the same court ruled that same-sex marriages are not currently recognized by the state constitution. So if this is going to happen in New York, it's going to have to come from our legislators. Last week, I spoke with Judy Disco, the director of administration at the Institute for Humanist Studies, about the issue of same-sex marriage. Judy is one of the people in New York directly affected by this issue. Judy, you are in a committed relationship with a very wonderful woman who I have met personally.
I am.
And I'm wondering, how long have you been in that relationship?
18 years.
18 years. Now, I'm not an expert on common law, and I think it varies from state to state, but essentially you would be married if you were a heterosexual couple under common law.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Are you interested in marrying your partner?
You know, we've had very long discussions about this. Part of us is not wanting to follow the heterosexual rule that's set up because obviously it's not that successful. 50% of marriages end in divorce. But for us, it's much of it is about just being recognized as a couple, not always having to explain, you know, who we are, what we are, you know, we own a home, we pay taxes, but when we go on vacation, I have to take our healthcare proxy with us, all our legal papers, because if something happens, we're not recognized.
Right.
So, and there's the other piece of this is that I'm not eligible at all for Barbara's retirement.
Yeah.
Because we're not married.
Right. So what kind of precautions have you taken since you're not granted some of these rights?
We have a healthcare proxy.
Mm-hmm.
We have power of attorneys. We have wills.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is in order. Mm-hmm. So in the event that one of us dies or is incapacitated and not able to make decisions.
Is the process more complicated if you're in a same-sex relationship than if you were legally married? I mean, is it more complicated to do this?
Well, you know, it's not more complicated, but it's just that you have to do it.
Right.
You know, heterosexual people don't have to.
They have a will, but
they don't even need a will because everything goes to the surviving spouse.
Okay.
So it's an added expense. It costs us probably, you know, $500 to $700 to have all these legal papers you know, made up.
Right.
So it's an expectation in a heterosexual relationship that the surviving spouse gets everything.
Right.
But not in a non-recognized union.
Right. Now, here in New York State, we recently had a court case that went to the highest court in New York, the Court of Appeals, and the judges decided that this was a matter for the legislature. How did you feel? You were there the day it happened. You were outside. How were you personally affected by that?
Well, it was kind of expected that that's what was going to come down from the courts because they wanted to go to the legislature for them to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I mean, I'm on the board of the Lesbian and Gay Community Center here in Albany, and we've been working on this legislative piece with the courts. We know the people that have been involved.
Mm-hmm.
It was still going down to that rally at 6 o'clock that night and being with other lesbian, gay people and you know, straight supporters.
Yeah.
There was a certain level of defeat.
Yeah.
It's like, here we go again. You know, we still can't be recognized.
Yeah, I can imagine that you were, even though strategically it's probably better for the legislature to rule on this so that it can't be later overturned, but I can still feel like part of you maybe was just hoping that maybe they would rule.
Sure. You know, it was like, oh, you know, that little piece of you held a glimmer.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the justices brought it all about children, that children need to be brought up in a heterosexual relationship where there are many heterosexual people that choose or are not able to have children.
Right.
So does that negate their relationship?
Right. They were saying that a marriage was designed
to produce children.
Right.
And, you know, that's nowhere in any law that that's what says marriage is about.
Right.
So it's just very interesting to see what's going to happen with all of this.
How do you feel about the institution of marriage? Some humanists have written into our newsletter saying that they think that as far as the state is concerned, they should only recognize a civil union. And if you want to call it marriage and you want to go through a ceremony, that should be your own separate sort of private religious ceremony. If you just had civil unions for
everybody.
Everybody would sort of level the playing field.
Right, exactly.
But so is that something that goes through your mind?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
However, because marriage is tied to a religious ceremony, you've got that whole religious base right now that is up in arms about the whole marriage piece.
Right.
I mean, I was married. You know, so I'm divorced, so I'm not I was brought up a Catholic. I'm certainly not a practicing Catholic, but I'm not recognized at all in the Catholic religion because I'm divorced and because I'm a lesbian.
Right.
So I have two strikes against me in terms of religion right now.
Right. Are all the opponents of same-sex marriage religious or?
No, they're not. I think there is a homophobia is an overriding piece, I think, to a lot of what's going on. People don't understand it. There's an ick factor that goes with this.
Right.
But many times it's a lot of closeted people who are the most outspoken against it. But I think the overriding piece is homophobia.
Uh-huh.
I really do.
Now, you mentioned that you're on the member of a gay and lesbian community organization. It's the Capital District Gay and Lesbian Community Council. What are they doing? Are they planning anything for the next phase?
We work very closely with the Empire State Pride Agenda, which is the premier New York State lobbying group.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a number of strategies that they will be using when the legislature comes back into session. We are kind of we're not an offshoot of them. I don't mean it that, but we're an ally of them, obviously.
Yeah.
And so whatever it is that they need the community to do, we're there to do it for them via our newsletter, via mailings.
Getting the bodies to show up.
Absolutely.
Protests.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with me. I wish
you
the best. Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
Hey, Jess, next time I'm going to let you go first.
Yeah, if you know what's better for you, you will.
You got to throw a few verbal elbows around here to get a word in with me. That song was Love Revolution by Almighty Whispers off the album Love Revolution. Check out almightywhispers.com for more info. So we just heard from Judy Disco, Director of Administration of the Institute for Humanist Studies. Judy has been in a same-sex relationship for 18 years and hopes to see the New York State Legislature pass a law recognizing same-sex marriage in New York. I hope they do, too. Jess, you're a lesbian.
Last time I checked, I was.
So how do you feel about same-sex marriage?
Well, personally, I'm not so much into the concept of binding myself by law to someone forever, mm-hmm. or, you know, asking permission to get out of that relationship. But yeah. I think folks in the LGBT community, if they want to get married, you know, for emotional reasons or recognition, but, you know, as citizens of the country or for religious reasons, mm-hmm. or even just economic, you know, and having rights as everyone else, they yeah. should definitely be able to. It'd be nice to have that option. But yeah. Personally, I don't see it being something that I want to do.
Right, right. Do you think that two men or two women who are not gay should be allowed to marry? So, in other words, should two heterosexuals of the same sex be allowed to marry?
I don't know. What's going to be after that? People wanting to marry their cows? I mean,
that happens in Malaysia. And actually, this case did come up in Canada, and we wrote about it in the H&N e-zine. I can't remember if it was two women or two men. They were straight, but they wanted to get married.
Wow.
I'll have to read the archives to remember how it turned out.
I mean, who am I to say no? I guess as long as, you know, everyone's got a reason. So I'm sure as long as no one's getting hurt or if, you know, getting taken advantage of, you know, yeah. I say go for it.
Yeah. All right. Well, we heard about same-sex marriage in New York State. Let's see what's going on in Washington with this issue. On Monday, I spoke to Lori Lipman Brown, who's the director and lobbyist for the Secular Coalition for America. Lori's a former Nevada State Senator. She is also the only full-time lobbyist for freethinkers in Washington. The Institute for Humanist Studies, which makes programs like Humanist Network News possible, is a founding member of the Secular Coalition for America.
Secular Coalition, this is Lori.
Hi, Lori.
Hi, Duncan.
I'm calling you to find out what's going on in Washington with the Marriage Amendment Protection Act.
Well, that has already failed in both houses.
Okay.
The Senate killed it, and then the House killed it.
All right.
But both houses knew it was going to get killed. It was just brought up by the leadership because it's a political toy.
Mm-hmm.
So both houses rejected for various reasons what I consider a theological definition of who can get married and who can't.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really quite exciting to watch how badly they lost that particular argument.
Mm-hmm. Well, are the people who are proposing this, do they know that it has no chance of passing?
Oh, they know. Yeah, they knew because it would have required a 2/3 majority in each house,
mm-hmm.
because it's a constitutional amendment they were suggesting. They knew that they didn't have those votes, but they wanted to do this anyway for political purposes so they could say when they go to run for re-election, look, I voted against same-sex people marrying. Look how good I am.
Mm-hmm.
as it turned out, some of the people who voted against it did so on because of the kinds of issues that I think are very important, that you don't mix a theological definition with a civil contract. And others voted against it just out of fairness. And there were some who actually do not believe there should be same-sex marriage, but voted against it because of federalism concerns about messing with the Constitution and not giving states the rights to do what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a lot of people across the spectrum who were against this for various reasons, but the far right or the religious right is kind of moving the agenda, so they wanted it to play out.
Now, what's the future of same-sex marriage in the U.S. then? Is this going to become a state issue, or is it going to keep coming up in Washington?
Currently, it's a state issue, but the folks in Washington, while the religious right has a hold on leadership positions, keeps bringing it up every 2 years, just coincidentally, whenever we're near an election cycle. So they may continue to do that. However, they've been losing votes along the way, at least in the Senate side. They only had 49 votes this time. So I think they may, even if they maintain leadership positions, they may start thinking that this is politically a bad thing to do because it shows how weak their position is. And you know, as society moves forward and people realize that the idea that the only people who should get married are a male and a female for visions of certain gender roles that people have to fulfill, that these kinds of sites will look sillier and sillier.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are you doing as a director and lobbyist for the Secular Coalition for America with respect to same-sex marriage?
On that issue, when I go in, I've been doing, or I did before the vote, obviously, a lot of visits with a larger coalition that included groups like the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, National Conference of Jewish Women, Human Rights Campaign, Gay and Lesbian Task Force. And what would happen is we would all go in together representing over 100 groups total, and half a dozen of us would make all of the different arguments as to why these folks should vote against the marriage amendment. So when it would come to me, I would talk about my feelings regarding not having a theocratic definition on a civil contract and the difference between what people do in their churches and religious marriage versus the contract of marriage that our government gives. Mm-hmm. And then other groups would talk about their parts of the issues. So, for example, the Gay and Lesbian Task Force or Human Rights Campaign would discuss the fairness of it, but that really isn't SCA's part of it. Oh, and the women's groups would talk about the fact that the second sentence of the amendment, which most people don't even notice, that there's more than just the definition of marriage in what they were proposing. The second sentence, based on what's been happening in Ohio and other states that have enacted something like this, mm-hmm. could even interfere with domestic violence laws, because it basically says same-sex couples shouldn't have any of the rights that opposite-sex couples get, whether it's through marriage or even something similar to marriage.
Mm-hmm.
In Ohio, they had their particular domestic violence laws said that spouses got certain rights to, for example, temporary restraining orders. So if you weren't a spouse or you weren't in a marriage-like relationship or an actual marriage, then you weren't eligible for under the amendment that passed in Ohio. It said non-married couples can't get what married couples get,
mm-hmm.
in situations where that's part of the criteria, is that they were living as if they were spouses.
Wow, I haven't heard this. Is it getting, was that getting attention in the media?
There are actually a number of cases that are still in litigation in Ohio, and some of the local courts have held that that is the effect, and other courts have held, no, that's not really what it means. So it's not clear what the final decision would be if it finally was decided, for example, in the Ohio Supreme Court or a national court. But as of now, some of the courts are finding that it does go that far. So you know, change the U.S. Constitution, not knowing what something means, and the people who are proposing the marriage amendment were arguing amongst themselves about what it meant.
Right. Lori, can you also explain these efforts to amend the Constitution to prevent same-sex marriage? They're related to another issue which has been in the news, stem cell research. It's all part of the American values agenda coming from the conservative right. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that one, you know, it's horrible when I think about what even the same-sex marriage debate does to same-sex families, or families that are headed by gay and lesbian parents. But this stem cell veto, because the stem cell bill did pass both houses,
mm-hmm.
and the president vetoed it, and there were not enough votes to override his veto, that is really a matter of life and death. And there have been some editorials that were done by people whose own children were suffering because they were not permitted or not able to try to produce eggs that are fertilized that might help their own child. And it's just really sad that it's gotten to that extreme. I mean, years ago I looked at this issue and thought, well, as soon as they get to stem cells, everyone will realize that they're a bunch of absolutely horrid people to take politics and just, you know, give up on medical research that could save people's lives for political gain. But I watched the president with all those little babies around him equating these little cells, these five-day-old group of cells, with babies.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what if people start believing that? I mean, I just don't know how far that kind of rhetoric might even convince people that we should stop doing medical research on cells.
Yeah.
That part's really sad.
Now, Lori, in your work...
One of the things that I was really excited about when we worked on the stem cell bill is that we did work with a number of medical organizations, and usually I don't get to do that in most of my issues.
And how many groups were you working with? What types of groups were these that you were in coalition with?
On our website, www.secular.org, if you go to the part where we talk about the stem cells, we have a copy of the letter we signed on to, and it has 591 organizations, mostly medical and research and universities.
Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen next with stem cell research? What's the next phase?
I would think that they would have to, well, some of the states and private organizations are trying to do some of the research, and there's also some research going on in other nations, of course. But the NIH, National Institutes of Health, this bill would have funded it through or allowed more research through NIH. And that's where most of this research really could happen. It's just much... much more promising to really invest in this at that level. So I think what will happen is this next election cycle in some races, like in Pennsylvania with Santorum's race, since he was a big proponent of not permitting stem cell research, this may become a very big issue. And I imagine if they have a big enough change this November in the makeup of both houses, that they might be able to bring it up again and have enough votes to override another veto.
Well, Lori, thanks a lot for talking with me.
Thank you.
And keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Every day I turn on the news. Every day it's the same bad news. Some fool starts another war. People dying out on every shore. I ain't no politician. I'm just a blues musician. This may sound silly. Us blues musicians have a several theory. If everybody loved the blues, there wouldn't be no war.
You're listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. That was Lori Lipman Brown, director and lobbyist of the Washington, D.C.-based Secular Coalition for America. I spoke with her Monday. Jess, what was the name of that song we just played?
That was If Everybody Loved the Blues, There Wouldn't Be No War.
No, there wouldn't.
Off the album Mean Guitar by Mean Gene Kelton.
Hey, new guy. Hey, new guy.
What?
Know what time it is?
Game time. No, what?
Listener comment time. So what do we have in the audio listener comment grab bag today?
Well, let's find out.
Hey there. This is Nate Berkepec from St. Paul, Minnesota, obviously in the USA. I heard you didn't get any comments last week. I feel for you. Here in Minnesota, humanism is definitely a minority, and so often I'm also left feeling alone. So I feel your pain. I love the show. This is the last episode. It was the first one I ever heard. And I'm definitely going to start listening to the other ones now. I definitely love the music because I didn't know it was that kind of humanist subject music. So I love that. Keep up the good work.
Hey, thanks, Nate. I like the music on our show, too. I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, but not as cool as last month when we played a song by Cersei.
In case you haven't checked out Jess's MySpace page, she's a Cersei groupie.
Yeah, Cersei.
All the songs in today's show, except for the theme music, are available at podsafemusic.com. Actually, I'm sorry, it's podsafeaudio.com. If you'd like to leave a listener comment for possible inclusion in our next show, call 206-339-4168.
For those of you too cheap to pick up the phone, no, I'm just kidding. We also have a Skype in mailbox. Our Skype name is HNN_editor. So yeah. HNN_EDITOR.
Yeah, that's very cool because you can call us for free from anywhere in the world doing that also. Skype is a free program. If you want to download it, go to Skype.com. That's SKYPE.com. Hey, I got an issue for folks to call in about. In next week's HNN e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org, there will be a letter to the editor responding to an article that I wrote introducing Jess to our readers. In the headline, I referred to Jess as our webmaster. You got to read the letter, I think, to get the full experience. But basically, it accuses our e-zine of yoking our female tech staffer with a patriarchal, socially conservative title. I'm paraphrasing slightly. You see, according to the letter writer, quote, webmaster is more of a male gender word, even if dictionaries define master as being either woman or man. For the record, folks, Jess's title is systems analyst / web programmer. Title doesn't exactly roll off your tongue or fit into a headline very easily, which is why I chose the more colloquial term webmaster for the headline. By the way, the letter doesn't give any suggestions on a better term. What do you think, Jess? Do you like the ring of, say, web mistress?
You know, that's all right. I think I prefer an IT girl, actually. That's my
IT
favorite.
Girl.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
That would look like It Girl.
I don't mind being the It Girl. I think there's a song called It Girl. We'll have to get that for the next week's podcast.
All right, folks. If you don't call in, Jess is going to start referring to herself formally as the It Girl. Okay? Call in and let us know what you think about the word webmaster. Is this yet another example of patriarchy? And, of course, since I use the word, I must be sexist.
That's right, folks. Call our listener line to tell us if you think Duncan is a sexist pig.
No, Jess. No. Pigs are gentle, sensitive creatures. Try sexist jerk.
All right. Jerk. So the listener comment line is 206-339-4168 by phone and HNN_editor by Skype.
All right. Let me just get off the soapbox for a minute. And here we go. Okay. The Alden March Bioethics Institute, a very reputable organization based at the Albany Medical College, recently hosted a large bioethics conference in downtown Albany. It's right across the street from the Institute for Humanist Studies. Some of the leading bioethicists and political thinkers from around the country came to speak on the topic of bioethics and politics, the future of bioethics in a divided democracy. Two of the speakers at the conference stopped by for an interview with us. We'll start with Chris Mooney. Jess, tell us a little bit about Chris.
Chris works as a journalist specializing in relationship between science and politics. He's a Washington correspondent for Seed magazine, and he's also written for Mother Jones, Wired, The Washington Post, Slate, and other publications.
I spoke with Chris two Fridays ago about his book, The Republican War on Science. Chris, can you explain, in your book, the Republican War on Science, is this phenomena of politicians distorting scientific facts, is this new to the political scene, or is this something that's been going on, you know, throughout history? Did it start with the Bush administration, I mean to say?
Well, you know, it probably, in some sense, shooting the messenger because you don't like the message probably goes back to Socrates,
right.
I guess. And throughout history and in different countries, there have often been conflicts between the people who are the purveyors of some kind of information and the politicians who don't like it in some sort of way. And one of the greatest corruptions of science that ever happened was Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union. So it's not like this doesn't happen at all in the past. Right. My argument is that for recent American political history, we've reached kind of a high watermark,
right,
in terms of the misuse and abuse of science. Just if you judge by the volume of the abuses coming from the current administration, or if you judge by their consequences, because, you know, on issues like climate change or misinformation about stem cell research, these are some of the biggest issues of the day,
right?
And they're rife with misinformation.
Corporate interests have been used to corrupt scientific evidence for a long time, but so have religious leaders do the same thing. What we have with the Bush administration is a combination of pressures from the religious aspects and also big business. Is that correct?
That's how I see it, yeah. Those are the two key motivating forces behind the attacks on science that we're seeing in the administration. If you break down the issues where these science fights are happening and you look at why it's these issues, sure enough, you trace it back to what group cares about these issues, and it's almost always, there are some that are a little complicated, but it's almost always either industry on the one hand, religious conservatives on the other. So industry cares about environmental, public health kind of things, mm-hmm. you know, regulatory, mm-hmm. The regulatory process, and then on the other hand, the religious conservatives care about reproductive health and stem cells, and, you know.
Right.
So the problem is, you combine them together, it's kind of the perfect storm,
right?
And that's what we have now under the Bush administration.
In your book, you outline five tactics that are used by the Republicans to misuse or abuse scientific information. What are the five tactics?
I'm not sure if I know exactly which five we're talking about. I feel like the list may be a little longer than
okay.
that. But let's just talk about a couple of them. One of the most common ones is exaggerating or misusing the concept of scientific uncertainty. So scientific information is always characterized by some measure of uncertainty. But does that mean that, you know, because you don't know everything, you can't take political action? Mm-hmm. And they often try to make that kind of argument. So that's one of the things, and sometimes they exaggerate the level of uncertainty.
We saw with the intelligent design controversy, I'm putting in scare yeah. quotes here, the misuse of the word theory.
Sure.
You know, from a common usage of theory to mm-hmm. the scientific. So that's an example, right?
Yeah, I'd say that I don't categorize that. The intelligent design people actually do exaggerate uncertainty about evolution.
Yeah.
So they do the magnifying uncertainty thing. The misuse of the word theory, just in terms of my categories, which you can take or leave, mm-hmm. Misuse of the word theory is, I think, you know, actually sort of fundamentally attacking the nature of what science itself is.
Right.
And the intelligent design people do that in another way when they argue that science is biased because it limits itself to natural causation. So there's all these different techniques, and we can go on and on and through them all if you'd like. I mean, let's see, one more. I talk about, you know, when a politician sort of cherry picks expertise,
mm-hmm.
and that is, you know, the vast bulk of the scientific community has come to a consensus on one thing, but the politician doesn't like that, so he goes out and finds one scientist or one or two scientists that think something else.
Yeah.
And then he says, oh, those are going to be my experts, rather than, you know, we want policy to be based on the best available science, and the best available science you best identify by looking at what the vast majority of the relevant experts think.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a politician goes around that and says, oh, I've got my one guy,
yeah.
you know, that's another form of, you know,
sure.
misusing science.
Tell me about the history of science and politics in the United States, because you specialize in following science and public policy.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the Republicans who first sort of brought scientists into the White House, or how does that
In some
that
sense, yes. I mean, science first became really, really prominent in public policy in the wake of World War II,
mm-hmm.
for obvious reasons. I mean, science helped us win the war,
yeah.
the radar and the bomb and so forth, and then the contract you know, with the nation in terms of how science was going to be used by FDR was that we were going to turn science, which had created such great benefits during wartime, to help society during peacetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of money was invested by the federal government in scientific research. And that sets the precedent for how science is treated today. Then with Sputnik, it ramped it up to another level because it looked like we were falling behind the Soviet Union in terms of our scientific competitiveness. And at that point, Eisenhower, a Republican, actually brought scientific advice into the White House for the first time by establishing the President's Scientific Advisory Committee, PSAC, or maybe President's Science Advisory Committee, PSAC. And this was sort of the golden age of science advice. And then Kennedy carried it forward, mm-hmm. and so forth and so on. Then there was a decline under Nixon. He actually got rid of his science advisors.
Fired them, right?
Yeah. But I think that the decline actually then got a little better, then got a lot worse with mm-hmm. Reagan, and now we're on a downhill.
Mm-hmm.
It goes up and down, but I think we are at a low point with Bush Jr. in terms of the relationship between scientists and political leaders in this country.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The level of distrust is pretty massive right now.
Well, how do you see a way to fix the solution? Because scientists don't create public policy, right? It's up to our elected officials to mm-hmm. Determine what to do with this knowledge. And it's up to our bioethicists to kind of determine what areas that science should be going in.
Sure, absolutely.
So what do you see as as a better model?
Scientists are entitled to have their views about these things, but when they have them, they're just citizens,
right?
You know, like anyone else. Citizens who happen to know a lot about science.
Uh-huh.
But I think there's something scientists can do. Beyond that, scientists need to be much more vocal in setting the record straight, even calling out and perhaps opposing politically politicians
mm-hmm.
who have distinguished themselves as real serious science abusers. You
right.
know? Politicians don't have a right to mislead us.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were held accountable more for this, maybe they wouldn't be as willing to do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the solutions involve scientists becoming much better communicators and much better political advocates.
Well, that brings me to another area of interest. You mentioned in your book, The Republican War on Science, that the media is more effective at getting this kind of bogus science, feeding it to the public, than any think tank or policy agency would, because of what I essentially have heard referred to as, you know, balance is bias. Is mm-hmm. that right?
Yeah, balance is bias. I think that's the name of a
study.
Good journal article
yeah.
actually on this topic. And yeah, the media is another part of the part of the problem and addressing it's part of the solution. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is we need to teach journalists who are covering complicated science, especially complicated science that's relevant to policy, that, you know, you can't always apply the same story structure to every story. Sometimes there's real debate over the science. Sometimes there's phony debate over the science.
Yeah.
I think journalists are responsible for being able to tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And phony debate is over evolution. Phony debate is over human role in global warming. The phony debate is created by special interests who profit by the notion that there is a debate. Journalists have got to be the gatekeepers. They've got to be the ones who call that stuff out.
And this is what's happening, basically. You have in the journalistic field, you talk to one side, and then you talk to the other side.
Right.
And just to give an extreme example, which doesn't actually happen, but suppose someone just finishes circumnavigating the globe. They interview that person, and then they give half of the article to a flat earther,
right,
saying, no, this didn't really happen because the Earth isn't flat. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but you have – they're giving equal time in the media to sort of bogus perspectives. Is that right?
In a lot of cases, yeah. I mean, I think they're actually becoming more aware of this problem and maybe getting a little better. But that's what I meant when I said, you know, creating a false debate whereas covering a real debate. The real case, you know, would be if a journalist, you know, goes to some group of scientists and, you know, they say, we can already see global warming making hurricanes stronger. And then he goes to another group of scientists and they say, we're not convinced that hurricanes are stronger yet. That actually is real. So you'd have to cover it as a controversy. The thing is, you can't apply the same model to every story.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, they just do the one hand on the other hand. They think that abdicates them of their responsibility to actually figure out what the state of knowledge is. No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I sometimes wish they would apply that same flawed model to the religion section of newspapers,
right,
for example.
Well, yeah.
Because I would love for them to require an atheist to be quoted for an equal amount of time.
Mm-hmm. That would be something.
We would actually benefit from that, but we don't. Know, we get hit on both ways.
It would be a little unfair, though, because if you had a story about every religion and then the atheist was the counterpoint,
you're
and
right.
every story about every religion, the atheist would get a lot more time than any of the religions.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I know. Keep dreaming, right? We were discussing with a religion editor at one of the Free Thought Head Summit about just the way newspapers, cover religion, and they sort of, they don't apply the same tests to religious claims that journalists are supposed to apply, because journalists are supposed to be skeptical.
Yeah, but it's socially unacceptable to do it in that context.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the way it is with
now,
the media.
Now, in your experiences, though, you're talking about, trying to train journalists more. What kind of training do journalists get if they're going to be covering science? I mean,
I think it wildly varies.
Uh-huh.
I generally think that the sort of tried and true science writers, many of them are actually PhDs who then become journalists rather than actual scientists, they're the ones that tend to know the science best.
Mm-hmm.
They have the least problems.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens, the real problems come in when a political reporter has to go to cover a science policy topic.
Uh-huh.
And then they cover it like any other political story. And the science writers often, you know, do a much better job, and they're often even angry at the political writers
right.
for how they do it.
Right.
The political writers are applying a different paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, someone who usually covers Congress then covers stem cells,
mm-hmm.
something like that. You know what I mean?
It does happen.
Oh, all
right?
the time. All
Certainly
the time.
Certainly for, like, newspapers, maybe not
yeah.
for a journal that comes out monthly mm-hmm. or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hi, this is Joel Pelletier, artist, musician, and creator of the American Fundamentalist painting, and you're listening to Humanist Network News.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
Humanist Network News is an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. Check us out on the web at humanistnetworknews.org or ihs.libsyn.com.
You can also listen to any of our shows directly from the podcast player on our MySpace page at myspace.com/humaniststudies.
We're listening to an interview with Chris Mooney, author of The Republican War on Science. In the first segment, Chris described how science in the United States came to be caught in the political perfect storm, a tornado of religious and corporate pressures, if you will. That cool song we're playing, by the way, is by Devin Anderson, off the album Somnolent Electronic Neo-Existentialism. The song is titled Bouncing to the Morgue. In the next segment, Chris will explain if the U.S. is indeed bouncing to the morgue as a result of the current administration's abuse of science.
Nice pun, Duncan.
Pun intended. In your opinion, what is one example in your book that you illustrate of just a misuse of an abuse of science that the Bush administration has pulled off that really didn't get that maybe our listeners wouldn't know about because it didn't get much play in the media?
Well, a lot of the below-the-radar meddling with the nature of the regulatory process and how science is used in order to allow the government regulatory agencies to either take action or not take action. Mm-hmm. All this stuff is incredibly complicated and bureaucratic, and most of it slips by relatively unnoticed. So the Bush administration has essentially embarked upon a wholesale alteration of the way of what kind of scientific evidence you need for a government regulatory agency to take action. And they've put in place all these tricky little maneuvers, the Data Quality Act, the peer review proposal, and now the, you know, changing the nature of government risk assessments, all of which are upping the burden of proof, this burden of scientific proof that you need before an agency can do anything, and tying the agency's hands, agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency. Mm-hmm. And I really object to this, because the state of affairs in terms of the role of science in the regulatory process is that the information's never that good.
Yeah.
There's always tons of uncertainty. You've got some new chemical. You know, you don't know what it's doing. It's in a complicated ecosystem. You have a limited amount of evidence. The studies are not ideal. But you don't, you're going to take 10 years to get better data, and maybe, you know, then you have X cases of cancer.
Yeah.
Or are you just going to do something? And what they are going to do is slow everything down.
Well, people are actually – this is a matter of life and death in some scenarios.
Or like, could be. I mean, you know, in a lot of cases, the agency doesn't actually know how many people may be at risk. But they say, we've got some evidence that there may be harm from this particular chemical. Uh-huh. Some evidence, and there's a lot of people who may be exposed to this. We've got to do something in a precautionary way. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Bush administration is getting rid of, is the whole sense of precaution. I object to that, because I don't want to be one of those people, you know, who at 65, you know, has a weird cancer and thinks, well, it must have been some environmental exposure at some point in my life. Don't know what it was. Never probably will know.
Right.
But now I've got cancer. So,
what do you see as the long-term effects of what the Bush administration has been doing with science, even after George W.'s term is over?
Well, you got to look at different issues play out differently, and the impacts of different issues are different. But the big picture is really the undermining of the ability of the government, and especially the agencies of the government that have to use science to do their jobs. The ability of those agencies to use scientific information to protect and serve the public interest, and the credibility that those agencies need in order to be able to do that role, in order to bring in good scientist employees and so forth. So I think it's weakening the scientific foundation mm-hmm. of key parts of the government.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at some of the issues, though, there's much bigger things going on. I mean, global warming, you know, as the president continues to pretend that there's a debate over whether humans are causing it, you know,
right.
we're actually getting quickly into a warm and warmer and warmer phase of this planet. And
yeah.
the temperatures are just rising and rising and rising. And if we don't do something soon, you know, we might pass some points of no return. So
mm-hmm.
the consequences there are massive for the entire planet, not just for the United States government.
Well, how many years is it going to take to undo what's been done so far in the Bush administration? I mean, for example, Al Gore is out there, you know, with his mm-hmm. movie on global warming, and it seems like the Democrats are mobilizing behind this issue.
Right. Well, it depends on, if we're talking about global warming still, then I suspect that the next president will be the one who deals with it
yeah.
in some way, because this one isn't going to. The consequence is going to be that we've dilly-dallied for 8 years. And what exactly, how much does that set us back? I'm not quite qualified to say, but
right.
you know, it's not a wise thing to dilly-dally
mm-hmm.
when you've got, you know, steadily rising concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we know that there's a long lag time until it fully takes effect.
Yeah.
So you just keep putting more up there and then say, hey, how hot is it going to get before we stop?
Right.
That's what we've been doing. So with that issue, you know, in terms of the credibility of the government generally, I mean, you know, that's sort of more of a staffing and institutional problem. I think that could be turned around. It would take some time.
Mm-hmm.
Because institutions change slowly.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it could be done, you know, 4 to 8 years.
Your book is partisan in its critique.
To some extent.
Well,
I wouldn't call it completely partisan.
Uh-huh. Well, because you talk about some moderate Republicans
mm-hmm.
Who are concerned.
It's certainly a book that's critical of the Republican Party. But does that mean that I'm indicting every single last Republican? No, it doesn't mean that. In fact, I actually am praising a previous incarnation of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
So this particular form of the Republican Party really troubles me because it misuses science constantly.
Right.
But we could have a different Republican Party. We could have a party that turns to the center, so forth.
Yeah.
And I would be much less critical. And in fact, I was, in 2000, I was a big McCain follower,
yeah,
to tell you the truth.
Well, he's a person that you do champion in the book, or you do at least say that this is a Republican who's out there who's outraged by
it. Certainly on climate change. He's actually, some of the things McCain has since said on evolution have soured me on him a bit. but on global warming, he's a leader. And the point is that there are different kinds of Republicans, but the party's currently run by its right. It's the modern conservative movement is essentially running the party.
Yeah.
And if it became more of a moderate Rockefeller, Nixon kind of party, I don't think my critique would hold anymore.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, what party would I be in? I don't know. I'd have to see.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about the Democrats. How are they actually reacting to this hijacking of science?
They're realizing they have an issue. Now, they're not 100% innocent, but they're not nearly as guilty. And they're realizing that there have been Democrats who have misstated things before on science. Of course there have. But they're realizing that this issue resonates, and I've been heartened to see. I mean, Al Gore is the number one sort of science policy champion by far, but I've been heartened to see other Democrats talking the talk and walking the walk. Particularly, I actually heard a speech by General Wesley Clark. I was there on the panel with him in Las Vegas at the yearly COS convention in June. And there's a guy who knows a heck of a lot about science and how important it is in the national future. And I was really impressed to hear that.
What are you what are you working on next?
I'm doing a book about the relationship between hurricanes and global warming and the very, very contentious scientific battle that's going on over that right now.
Mm-hmm. And are you going to be publishing this as articles first and then as a book, or how does your writing process work?
The last book was published in part as articles. This book likely will be published all new.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and hopefully in 2007.
Uh-huh.
I'm in the middle of working on it right now.
Okay, great. Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with me today. Is there anything else that you'd like to get in that I forgot to cover?
No, I think we've done a good job of covering this topic. I mean, I'm still amazed at how high profile the politics of science has become. You know, it's a complicated issue, and not only is it a complicated issue, it's a complicated mess of a wide variety of different complicated issues.
Yeah.
And yet, nevertheless, somehow everybody's really fired up about this. I think that really says something about this moment that we're in.
Yeah.
And we could speculate about why it's so big. So high profile. I suspect it has something to do with the personality of George W. Bush and the perception that, right or wrong, I think to a large extent right, that he is not very open to different kinds of information, that he makes up his mind and then, nothing will knock him off the course.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why this issue really resonates, is because it's seen as something reflecting the president's character itself. That, otherwise, issues don't get as big as this.
Right. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. That was an interview with Chris Mooney, Washington correspondent for Seed Magazine and author of The Republican War on Science. Check out www.waronscience.com for more info on Chris's book. I think that interview went pretty well. What do you think, Jess?
You know, Duncan, you just might be the next Diane Sawyer.
Diane Sawyer, really. I was hoping for Terry Gross, maybe. Well, I read Chris's book, and there are tons of other issues in his book that we didn't get to talk about in the interview. Obesity, for example. There's a whole section of Chris's book that talks about the ways in which the food industry and the soft drink industry have been pressuring Washington into downplaying the effects of sugary foods and beverages that are basically creating an obesity epidemic in this country.
That's right. Obesity is a big problem.
Oh, you're a regular pun star, aren't you? big problem.
That's right. And if I weren't so addicted to sugar, I might just get up and do something about
it. Yeah, or chocolate. Jess has all this chocolate hidden throughout the office.
Organic Belgian chocolate. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. All right, so who's next? Let's see. Dr. Anna Lita, director of the IHEU Opignani Bioethics Center at the United Nations in New York. Jess, did you know that the Institute for Humanist Studies is a member of the International Humanist and Ethical Union?
Yeah, I think I remember you saying something about that last week.
Of course you do. IHS represents the IHEU in the UN system, and we also work closely with Annalita, our resident bioethicist in New York. Anna spoke at the recent bioethics conference in Albany, and I talked to her afterwards about human cloning.
Human cloning is a way to reproduce, but I would like to be on the side of some of the professors in our advisory board, like Peter Singer and Art Kaplan, mm-hmm. and they do consider reproductive cloning being a pseudo-bioethical issue. And you know why? Because no matter how interesting the speculations about clones might be, no matter how interesting the stories might be, no matter the articles and novels and movies about clones, at this moment, we are not ready to clone people. The technology is not that advanced. Mm-hmm. These are only speculations about where the technology can go, and not at all about how fast. Probably in 100 years, we will have clones. But that's not the point. What we have, though, there is an advancement in cloning animals. And recently in Korea, the first dog was cloned, and it's much more difficult to clone dogs than cats. Mm-hmm. And we know that in California, cats are already cloned, and the price depends on the market. Ranges from $30,000 to $50,000, mm-hmm. so people can clone their cats. Now, there is, however, a difference where we need to make a distinction between research cloning and reproductive cloning.
Therapeutic cloning, I think.
Cloning, right. And the debates are absolutely, I should say, dreadful. Mm-hmm. And just today in this conference, there were people drastically saying, and we should probably qualify those people as conservatives, mm-hmm. Radically saying that we should stop telling those who are injured, for instance, mm-hmm. or those who still have a hope and they have different diseases like Alzheimer, that the technology will be perfected and the technology will advance so that they will still have a chance to be cured based on embryonic stem cells. Mm-hmm. And on the other side of the picture, we had people saying, no, we should not be so radical. We should give scientists the freedom to go ahead researching that. And then we should not go back and having the same debates as we had when in vitro fertilization technology was was debated.
Right.
And a couple of years, well, in 1975, right, before Louise Brown was born, the debate around in vitro fertilization was heated as the debate about embryonic stem cell research is today.
People didn't
and look what happens right now.
It's now accepted.
Even in Eastern Europe, after the end of the Cold War, mm-hmm. we have fertility clinics, and they are functioning pretty well. Yeah. And they do help, of course, infertile couples to have children. Well, there are problems with that, but that's another question.
Right.
Personally, this is my personal view. I do believe that if we really encourage scientists to go ahead and doing what they know best, and trying to probably clone human beings, although that's a huge problem concerning the research ethics and using as research subjects, you know, embryos, right? But I wouldn't actually focus on that. Because your question is, if we were to reach that stage and technology be able to clone human beings, mm-hmm. would I consider those human beings different
yeah.
than those naturally conceived? No, I wouldn't consider them different.
Right.
I think they can have the same moral standing as we have. And again, going to the same example with in vitro fertilization, Louise Brown and all children, born after this in vitro fertilization procedure, they have the same moral standing like us.
That was Dr. Anna Lita, director of the IHEU Abignani Bioethics Center in New York. So what do you think, Jess? Should I clone myself?
Well, I'm actually having a hard time thinking of things that I'd like even less than that, Duncan.
Oh, really?
That's right.
Okay. Well, for our last segment of this month's podcast, we have a treat from Jeff Swenson, whose cartoon Freethunk appears weekly in the Humanist Network News e-zine, which can be found at humanistnetworknews.org. Jeff reviewed the TV show Psych, airing on the USA Network.
What's the name of that show again, Duncan?
Psych.
You want to spell that out for our listeners here?
Okay, in case you didn't catch in the beginning, I mispronounced it and I called it Skype because I have Skype on the brain because I set up an inbox where people can call in and leave listener comments through Skype. Which, by the way, what's our Skype name again, Jess?
What's our Skype name? HNN underscore editor.
Okay,
see how
that's
that right. just rolls off naturally?
Yeah, yeah,
see how
yeah.
I got that?
Okay, here's Jeff.
Psych, a TV show review by cartoonist Jeff Swenson. Airing on the USA Network, this show has the potential to be a skeptic's favorite.
When I was in the department, there were two things I hated in this world. Private investigators and psychics.
There may be good news for skeptics who are looking for a TV show that is both entertaining and satirical towards psychic detectives. Psych is a concept that is not in your face skepticism, but makes a point with its very premise, that someone can appear to be psychic simply by having observational skills. The pilot opens up with a young Sean Spencer eating lunch with his dad, Henry Spencer, who works as a cop. It's 1986 in Santa Barbara, California. Henry is hard on his son, most likely because he wants him to grow up to be a police officer. So he tests him every chance he gets on his memory and ability to observe his surroundings. With his eyes shut, we get to see what Sean is remembering in his head as name tags, hats, and other objects are zeroed in on and highlighted. Anything related to the test questions his dad poses. In the end, young Sean is rewarded with a piece of cake. Move forward to 2006. And Sean is fooling around with what appears to be a woman he just picked up at a bar. The mood of the moment suggests that Sean may not have grown up to be the responsible, career-minded adult his dad wished for. As he's trying to make it with this girl, the TV flips on by accident. The couple rolls over on the remote. And Sean sees a news story where he spots several clues that could lead to the conviction of the perpetrator. He calls them in as tips, which indicates to us that indeed Sean has not pursued an official job in law enforcement. Figuring out the solutions to crimes is more of a hobby to him. He almost comes off as spoiled and lacking ambition. One thing leads to another, and the police call Sean in to interrogate him because he knows too much. His own observations are so good that they have made him into a suspect. In order to explain himself and escape being held in a jail cell with some guys looking hungry for more than just food, he suddenly uses the excuse that he's a psychic. After all, most people would rather jump to a supernatural conclusion than to a natural one when confronting something that is beyond their comprehension. Sean then cements his psychic status by using some observational skills that seem unexplainable, except that we, the audience, have already been clued in. One of the detectives, Carlton Lassiter, thinks Sean is full of it, but he can't prove anything, which is a source of humor throughout the pilot episode. The rest of the storyline is a standard murder plot with an unlikely suspect. Nothing shocking or extraordinary, but a competent whodunit. So there we have it. A man who claims to be a psychic detective, but in reality is using observational skills to fool the police and the public, and has no shame in doing so. This is the kind of guy you hate as a skeptic, right? Well, the show is able to overcome that for several reasons. The main character, Sean, is a cross between Ben Stiller and Tom Cruise, and if the show only focused on him, I think we would be annoyed. But when Sean recruits his reluctant, lifelong friend Burton Guster, or Gus, the situation morphs into a buddy comedy, or what I usually refer to as a modern vaudeville act. Gus isn't a willing participant. We relate to him and not to Sean. Sean simply amazes us with his skills. Gus is there to provide our voice in asking Sean, what the hell is he doing posing as a psychic? Sean alone would have been like, well, Ben Stiller alone without somebody to play off of. But with Gus playing the straight man in the buddy comedy, we have the balancing act we need. The other reason we have some definite potential with Psych is the audience is let in on the gag, and we are constantly curious about which observation will be used to fool someone. The character of Sean Spencer is out for gain, as he explains to his dad, who thoroughly disapproves of him using his gift as a psychic. But Sean's offenses are tempered by the skeptics in the police force trying to catch him making a mistake. I'm not even sure if you can call it a con game. Sean is providing a legitimate service where he does actually solve crimes using the skills he developed as a child. He is just not being honest as to how he comes to his conclusions. The interim police chief Karen Vick gives us the impression that she knows he's not a real psychic. However, he's still worth keeping around because whatever he's doing is working in her favor. In the real world, psychic detectives waste time and tax dollars going off of feelings and hunches, which they interpret as psychic powers, but maybe nothing more than a dream, or the same intuition a true detective uses, except a trained cop's intuition is significantly better than an airhead psychic. They also prey on victims to increase their own fame and fortune. There are psychics who truly believe they have psychic abilities, but they are so damn arrogant. They won't submit to any test to prove their claims because there is no valid test that they can agree upon. It's all subjective, which is the same as saying that we are all psychic if we want to be, and thus this attitude renders the term psychic meaningless. I guess that's why I'm seeing the potential for Psych. It's a show that exposes cold reading and observations and shows how they can be used to seem like you're psychic. It's done in such a way that those people who are always complaining that skeptics are no fun will watch Psych. Now, will these non-skeptics put two and two together? I'm not sure. People who strongly believe in the supernatural can witness a debunking of a psychic, but isolate the incident so that it doesn't apply to all psychics. Those who have never given much thought either way to supernatural phenomena are the best bet for this show to reach out to. A little common sense interpretation of seemingly unexplainable predictions could go a long ways to improving the skeptical abilities of our society as a whole. I'm doubtful that USA Network is on any sort of debunking mission here. Their only concern is to make an entertaining show that sells advertising. A psychic who is a fraud but still solves the case is an original twist in a sea of fictional and non-fictional shows that applaud psychics. It's almost fortunate that so many unimaginative TV execs out there are producing so much psychic dribble that to be original, USA Network had to come up with something that rebelled against the psychic phenomena is real premise. My only fear with this show is that the producers or network will be tempted to introduce a real psychic into the show to compete with Sean, possibly because of low ratings and a need for a gimmick to give it a boost. Every show requires some time to find its footing. If the show doesn't generate enough support, then that's when they mess with the formula, and that's when they do stupid things like introduce real psychic phenomena. So first of all, go watch the show. It's in the on-demand section if you have Comcast cable. And then second of all, email USA Network and tell them you like the show. As freethinkers, we are usually very vocal, so be vocal about support for this program. Demonstrate that there is a market for this approach to psychic nonsense. I've said before that as much as I love all of the freethinking intellectual literature available out there, popular culture will always have more influence and reach. Not that pop culture can't be intellectual, but let's face it, psych is commercial entertainment with an emphasis on one-liners and quick laughs. The public at large could probably improve their minds more by studying a book. That ain't gonna happen. A clever TV show is our next best chance to get people to be more skeptical. This has been a Freethunk audio presentation by Jeff Swenson from Freethunk.net.
You've been listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
So, did you enjoy your flight, my co-pilot?
Now, Duncan, did you check the gender reference there of a co-pilot?
Oh, the gender reference of co-pilot. No, but I did check the gender reference of cockpit.
Terrible. Terrible, terrible.
Well, that's our show. Please join us again next month. In the meantime, don't forget to read our weekly e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org.
And don't forget to visit us on MySpace at myspace.com/humanist studies.
Our listener comment line is 206-339-4168. Or you can Skype us a message. Our Skype name is HNN_editor. The Humanist Network News podcast is produced in Albany, New York at the Humanist Center, headquarters of the Institute for Humanist Studies. The use of our theme song, I Ain't Afraid, was generously donated to the Institute by singer-songwriter Holly Near. You can hear more of her music at hollynear.com.
Folks, thanks for listening. For the ego of the hour, the one